Welcome, everybody, to the Dyslexically Successful podcast. I'm so excited to share the stories of these individuals, their stories of triumph and encouragement and inspiration to move through some really challenging things in their lives, whether it is learning to read or even just graduating from school, getting a job, being able to find their strengths that they have within them to be successful. And absolutely, I want to foster an understanding that their success is not in spite of their dyslexia, but it is because of it. And so I'm so glad to have you listening to these stories today. I am so excited to have you listen to this podcast episode. In this episode, we'll be speaking with Chris Riley from Splunk, and he has so much insight into the world of the dyslexic mind. It's uncanny at how many similarities he and I share in the sense of our higher level or broad picture thinking, and he's just got a lot of great insights into how to take advantage of the strengths you or your child has as a dyslexic learner. Some things for you to listen for in this episode. His work, Splunk, allows people just to be human, and also just understanding that it's no way to live to close in onto yourself thinking that you are flawed because of these differences. Another thing to think about as he talks here is just which of your talents will allow you to be successful. That for every thing that you find challenging right now, there is an equal and opposite talent or strength that you have, and that we can support and work on those to help really bring out the best in you. So as he calls them a group of misfit toys, you know, we are all valuable as people, and we have many differences, and those differences are really what sets us apart and what helps us add value to our own lives, our families, our workplaces, and that needs to be celebrated. So here we go, this interview with Chris Riley. Welcome, everybody, to the Dyslexically Successful podcast. And today on the show, we're going to be talking with Chris Riley. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I'm so excited to have you here. You're actually my first guest in this Woo-hoo. Season. Yeah, season two. We're going to talk about dyslexic adult learners and kids too. And just so excited to have you and just really appreciative of your time today. So why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit about who you are and what you're doing?
Yeah. So, and like I was saying earlier, we're live from my basement. Well, not live, but my background is not the most appealing. I apologize for that. But I get to talk about the tech stuff later too. That's like a thing.
Yeah.
Sorry. So yeah. So my name is Chris Riley, and you know how we met, I think, is actually really interesting. We live in the same neighborhood, and I saw a posting that you put on Nextdoor over a year ago now. And when I respond to that, it really created this kind of aha moment for myself of kind of the facets of living with dyslexia, like some of the things that you should practice to really help yourself. And one of them is just mentorship. So, it was exciting to, be able to connect with you. And my background, although I'm a Colorado native, I've only been back in Colorado for 2 years now. I currently work in tech. I work for a company in Boulder called Splunk. And I've always kind of been in the tech field. That's where I went to school at Regis University, got a computer science degree, and really always focused on in the tech area. So that's what I'm doing today. I have two little girls, Ava and Maisie. And I think, unfortunately, work is pretty much all consuming and becomes my hobby, as you probably understand as well. but I, when I'm not working, I do have some eclectic hobbies like my Apple collection and my Lego collection and things of that sort. So if I ever get a chance to do something that's just purely fun, that's what I'm doing.
Fantastic. That's great. When did you learn that you were dyslexic?
Yeah. So and I had intended to like dig up these papers. I've always, since I started learning how to read, it's always been a struggle. And you know, at that time, it was before dyslexia was really understood or even labeled. And, you know, it was just kind of treated as somebody who has remedial reading skills. And throughout my entire growing up, early adulthood, I really struggled with written communication. But the people around me mostly treated it as laziness. I kind of just kind of accepted that for myself as well, even though I didn't necessarily feel that that's what it was. It wasn't until I was 33, and I'm 38 now, until I figured it out officially. And it was not because I went in to actually deliberately look at, you know, the challenges I have with writing, reading, and communication that way. It was actually related to other anxiety disorders. So I'm also bipolar, and you know, everything, all of this stuff kind of lumps together in my head. And I think, you know, they're related somehow. I don't know exactly how. I don't know if one begets the other, but it was really a very intense period of self-discovery where I got a better diagnosis around my bipolar disorder and figured out I was dyslexic with surface dyslexia.
That must have been a very eye-opening time for you, just to get that insight about all these things that you were being told as a child, or you were experiencing dealing with people, and then now there's a name for it, or in your case, a couple of
right
names, and to go through your whole childhood, you don't know any better, you don't know any different, and you probably think everybody
right
is
right
the same way.
Well, I knew they weren't. Well, I mean, well, unfortunately, in school during those times, they pulled you out of class.
Yeah.
Like middle class, they pull you out. I actually ended up, when we moved back to Colorado, I was going through stuff, and it was quite interesting. I pulled up all these old reports. One was from my school, and then one was from my church, which that one kind of really surprised me, because apparently I was being evaluated by people, and I didn't know at the time I was even being evaluated. They didn't tell me. It was just kind of an exercise that was going on. I don't blame my parents for any of this, but the type of language they would use in these reports was just, it's just crazy. Like, I think one of them was, you know, something around like, we don't feel that Chris has other learning impairments. Like, it was very almost critical of myself and my ability, but then it like complimented my enthusiasm and willingness to try and all that stuff. But that experience was awful. I mean, and it's part of why when I was in school, I didn't have any friends at all, because you just couldn't. I mean, it was social suicide to be at that young age, to be ripped out of in the middle of the class and everybody knows where you're going.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Have you heard of the book called Normal Sucks?
I have. I haven't listened to it because I wouldn't read it. But it's I like the title just by itself, just because I pride myself in building relationships with who I refer to lovingly as the misfit toys. So those people who are not, don't necessarily fit the norm. And I tend to get along with those type of personalities better. So I'm assuming that that's about what it's about.
Yeah. Jonathan Mooney, if I am so lucky, he will be able to come onto this podcast, here in the next couple of months, but he wrote a few books, but he's dyslexic himself. And, he actually lived in Colorado for a while. He's not from Colorado, but, he wrote another book called The Short Bus. And, but this one about normal sucks, it really parallels your story quite a bit. And I think you would enjoy, especially from a man's perspective, like feeling that as a child. And, you know, I think to myself, as a pediatric physical therapist, I'm working with kids all day and I'm charting and writing and describing their behaviors and describing what they're doing. And I really have to take a minute to stop and say, hey, I don't really know what's going on with these children. Right. And if they were to read this, or even if their parents were to read that, is that going to be something that's, I don't, like, what is that? Our thoughts and feelings, actions, those all impact who we are with. Even if it's just thoughts in our head, but especially for you to go back and read that later, that would have been, I don't know that I would want to read that about me. As a little kid, I was loud. I was in everybody's face. I talked too fast. I remember pinching. There's a boy that I liked in the fourth grade and I would pinch and scratch him on purpose. Horrible. I know I did this. Anyway, so, but yet we still grow up to be productive members of society.
Absolutely.
And so, yeah.
And I mean, I think that was the big deal around, like I was saying at the very beginning, how we met. Such a huge part of all of this is not normal sucks. I mean, it's not about like fixing something. None of this is about fixing things. It's about just having enough awareness. And awareness, I think, is both awareness with yourself and awareness for the people around you. But the self-awareness is huge. And the game that a lot of people play with themselves is, you know, thinking that they're flawed and not understanding that, like, you know, don't waste time on, that's not an exercise worth having, thinking that you're broken and you need to fix it and, oh, maybe someday you'll fix it. It's not that. It's more like, what does this allow you to do now? What are you capable of doing now that other people aren't? Because I've found that dyslexia has actually become kind of a talent of mine of sorts, where it's actually really benefited me in my career. And how do you compensate for the areas that are challenging? So, and I think that, you know, this podcast and having conversations like that are what gonna make other people who've maybe sheltered themselves, gone with inside themselves and blame themselves, kind of drop that part of it, because it's just not worth the effort and energy.
Yeah, 100% agree with that. And awareness, like you said, needs to come from the person, which my husband, I have to credit my husband for drawing out my awareness, because like, even as I'm talking to you, especially when I get nervous, I look away, and he was always bothered by that. Like, why don't you look at me? And I have no awareness that I'm not doing that. Like, I think I'm looking at you right now. I'm pretty sure I am. But if we go into
you know what I do? I just look at my video. That's my trick. Cause I'm on Zoom calls constantly, and yeah, I have this problem. I mean, yeah, isn't that, it's funny. I also, my facial expressions get me in trouble a lot. Cause I will emote facially to pretty much everything that I hear. And sometimes I'll finish a meeting. People are like, well, what was wrong, Chris? Uh-huh. And I hadn't said a whole word the entire meeting. I'm like, oh, great. All right. Now I have to explain what my reaction was to that. Or sometimes I'm just off in the weeds and I'm thinking about something else. So.
But back to the emotion, if you're emoting on your face, do you feel like you have a sense truly of how you're feeling?
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
Okay.
I think I'm very aware of what caused it. I'm just not so aware that it's happening right in front of everybody.
That's an issue I personally have. Like, I might be acting or showing that I'm upset or whatever, but not have a conscious awareness of it. And I literally have to get my emotion wheel out and look at it to label my emotion, because otherwise I'm either happy or crying. So for me, it's not so easy to like say, oh yeah, I am feeling that way, but it's a process.
Yeah.
But like you said, it's all lumped together. And as a child, and probably even as parents, it's hard to distinguish like what is causing what, or these behaviors, right, or what we're looking at, where is this coming from? But I do think, you know, the more self-awareness that you can have, then you as the person can start to make those connections between a perceived sensation of safety or threat. That really is the bottom line. Like, do I feel safe in my environment with what's going on right now? And if so, I can use all of my wonderful cognitive capacity that I have. But if I don't feel safe, then I'm going to start talking really fast, yeah, or really loud, or not paying attention. So,
right.
Anyway.
Yeah. So when I was a kid, I want to be careful not to like throw a classification out there. So I'll say it most resembled agoraphobia. But I just couldn't go in public places. I would get physically sick anytime I was in public places. So fast forward to now, even though it's early in the morning and it may not sound like it, but now my primary job is to go and speak at trade shows and be in large rooms of people and interact and network. And believe it or not, another massive part of my job, and I can explain in a second how this works, is writing. And it's completely different than when I was a kid. And maybe it was just that, like I just, you know, what was going on with me at school and my interactions with other people, and kind of, you know, I lash out at times that just kind of didn't make sense. Maybe that was all just not feeling comfortable in my own skin and in my environment, because we never kind of gone through the journey of, like, it was all stated as a problem. It was never stated as like, this is a, you know, this is an exercise you're going through, and like you're learning adapting skills and, you know, all of this stuff, but it came together. My biggest fear, and the reason I am committing to, you know, this the panels that you've been put on in this podcast and hopefully more, is that there's somebody who has gone 100% in their shell. And once you've done that, the more you do it, the harder it is to escape. I know when I first moved to Colorado, I became super introvert for like 3 months. And that's a scary exercise. And if you do that and nobody has a chance to kind of say, all right, come on. Like, it's, you know, this is not, you're not broken. let's go through the journey. Like, let's face the world. They have to get this information somehow and break out of that.
Yeah. Thank you. I agree. I think that I'm happy to hear that even just the impact I've had on you to start what you've got going on at your job. I mean, part of, what you'll talk about here in a second is exciting. 'Cause when I started to have this idea, a year ago, December, I didn't really, I also heard it on a podcast.
a parent in Pennsylvania thought that it would be really great if more parents brought dyslexic adults to a community discussion. And I thought, well, I can do that. And so I did. Right. So, you know, just one simple idea can have a big impact on, even if it's just one other person. So hopefully this podcast will reach more than one person, but, but yeah, that's wonderful. So you have been doing something really cool at your job now. Why don't you go ahead and tell us about that program?
Yeah. Well, maybe so let me spend just a second on like what it means to be in the career force, the workforce with dyslexia. And then I'll lead that into the amazing things that my Splunk is doing. They've always done around diversity, but what they're doing right now specifically around neuro. So my job, the title of my job is a tech advocate, and externally I engage with practitioners. So developers, techies, these are people who are head down, coders, engineers, learn about what they do and also help them learn about what we do. And then internally in the company, I represent them. I represent the practitioner. I make sure that we understand how we approach them, how we market to them, you know, how we explain our technologies to them, how we align our technologies to what they do. This role is super interesting as it relates to dyslexia. And I've never done a survey of how many advocates out in the world, tech advocates out in the world are dyslexic, but my guess is there's quite a few. And the reason for that is because dyslexia impacted my ability to be a good software developer. And it was so frustrating because conceptually, I'm great at application, and this just sounds like bragging. It feels wrong, but I'm good at architecting applications. So I'm good at conceptually, you know, building the framework for applications and understanding how they should be built. When it came time to actually building them, I was a very bad coder. I could prototype very well, but my prototypes could never go from prototype to something that was releasable to the world. And it was always silly, small issues. It was nothing huge, but it's small as like semicolons and, you know, basic stuff like that. So my problem was I love tech and I was all about tech. And where I found a talent is that, I can continue to communicate with the engineers and have engagement with them and understand them. And I can also explain tech fairly well to those who aren't technical. So this unique role didn't exist when I first started in the workforce. It became popular probably about 6 years ago. Microsoft had a big hand in making it a popular thing. But it's very uniquely suited for my skill sets, and that has to do with dyslexia, which is the ability to conceptualize stuff very well, but challenged with getting into the weeds, details. And I get to do that. So I get to share knowledge that eventually becomes, you know, assets and speaking sessions and blog posts and, you know, things of that sort that are very valuable. The other part of my job is blogging. And I think anybody who talks to somebody who's dyslexic and realizes that they write a lot is kind of like, wait, what? The magic of that is that I almost never reread my blog posts. It's actually fairly rare. I have to write all at once. I can't write and then go back. I have to, if I'm going to write a blog post, I sit down and I write the full thing end to end. And it's fine because I'm putting a stream of consciousness on paper. What it takes is somebody to be patient in their copy editing and understanding. And I've always had that. So I've been very fortunate to have amazing copy editors behind me. And I write probably about 20 blog posts a month in the tech field. But the other thing about the tech field is the content is very structured, which helps. So it's a bit formulaic, And which allows you, it prevents too much deviation and kind of keeps things neat. So that's what I do. Prior to Splunk, I was working for a analyst firm, essentially, and I've been at Splunk for 5 months now. And Splunk is a San Francisco-based tech company, public tech company, very well known in the tech field. What they have done, so they've had amazing diversity programs, but just recently they launched a neurodiversity program, and dyslexia, bipolar, ADHD, spectrum disorder, you know, all of these things are kind of in that umbrella. And I got behind it, you know, it's being driven from San Francisco, but I'm getting as involved in that group as I possibly can, just because I think it's really cool to work in a place where the human element is just like, it's expected, because my condition is not necessarily unique. And especially in the tech field, you know, various mental disorders are all over the place. Like that's, it's probably more of the norm than not. So allowing people to come into work and just drop everything at the door and just be human, just be themselves, is amazing. And I'm not going to say it doesn't come with challenges. I know I have a few coworkers that they're very patient, but I know they are frustrated when I, you know, type messages in Slack sometimes, and it irritates them. And one of the recent ones, which was kind of funny, was I didn't realize that piqued my interest was not peaked as in mountain peak, you know, PEA. And so coworker corrected me, and I'm like, God, here we go again. Like this is one of these ridiculous words that doesn't sound like it's written, and it's just annoying as hell. But I think I'm lucky, and I think maybe, I don't know how unique the tech world is, but I think that the tech world has really made all of this okay. As long as you are a highly productive, like with your roles and responsibilities, if you're highly productive and you're good at what you do, then everything else is, you know, like be a human, be yourself. We're not going around and like trying to pander to each other and, you know, creating all these, like we're not spending a whole bunch of time creating, adapting to each other and creating safety nets and all that stuff. The biggest thing for me is that I can walk into the office and I can be Chris, not go, oh, I'm Chris, and I have this little secret that is not, in most organizations, not socially acceptable to share. Mm-hmm. So don't tell your boss, and for me, it's like, no, it's totally fine. Like when my boss gets frustrated at me for spelling peaked wrong, piqued my interest wrong, you know, it's not because I was lazy and did it to be annoying. It's like, I really didn't understand that, because it's ridiculous, by the way, any sense at all. And it makes me so mad.
Oh yeah,
I have a lot of funny stories like that. Like for until I was like 35, I always thought scapegoat was escape goat. Oh. Like a goat that you and that became a running joke for a long time, and some of that stuff's just funny. I mean, it's fine.
Well, so then, you know, you probably also have some phonemic awareness issues too, in addition to your surface dyslexia, just because to be able to pull apart those sounds and words, I have that for sure. And that's why in Spanish, like I've been studying Spanish, it's my undergraduate major, and I still have a hard time understanding what other people say. My receptive language skills are way below my expressive language skills, which is backwards, because I don't have the ability to really pull apart those sounds. If I learn a right. new word, I have to, thank God I have a phonics background. I have to write the word out and say it phonetically like 20 times before I can say it. Otherwise you're going to come out with funny.
Yeah. Yeah. And I wish I could remember all of them. There's been a lot. I should start writing.
Make a list.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that one of the things that like I did that maybe was a kind of a cheat was I avoided written communication a lot, and I avoided consuming information by reading a lot. The bad side of that was there were gaps. Like people would say, you know, read this book before this meeting. Well, that didn't happen. Mm-hmm. You know, stuff like that. But however, it created this need for me to synthesize information from other sources. And that I think is really where I became very skilled at communicating tech to people who were not technical. And also being able to see trends in the industry from like an analyst perspective. So I do think that I would have challenged myself, and I should challenge myself to not gloss over reading as much as I do. The other nice thing about the tech world is brevity is kind of expected. So, you know, we spend a lot of time with Slack and text messages and, you know, stuff like that. And short, sweet communication is kind of expected.
Right.
And so that helps me a lot as well.
That's funny that you mentioned that. So at one of my job reviews from my employer, their only criticism of me was that I needed to be more friendly in my emails, that I was too short. And I'm kind of like, well, I don't want to go on and on and on. So I just get to the point because I know that I have the tendency to do that. So then I end up going the other way. And they're like, can you please put more fluff in your emails? So I have to intentionally add that in. And unfortunately, even with my coworkers, it looked bad on me that I was being short and abrupt. But really, I was just trying to get to the point because I have a tendency to go on. But that was just interesting. The only thing they had negative to say about me was that, and okay.
Well, you're killing it. That's good.
Yeah, well, but there are other things, but I can totally see what you're talking about and how wonderful for your current role to take that big picture exposure and to be able to explain it, like you said, synthesize the information so that all these different people and all these different roles can get an idea of what's going on. I think in general, people are so much more focused on details and we are not.
Right. And the more and more I think about it, like I really am lucky in the industry I'm in. I mean, tech is a lot more forgiving for this kind of stuff. But also, I don't interact a lot with, let's say, accounting, where, you know, precision and that kind of details matter a lot. I interact with salespeople and I interact with marketing people. A lot of times engineers, especially out in the world, but also internally engineers. And in those conversations, I don't get put on the spot where it would really trip me up. So it is very fortunate to, I don't know if I sought out tech for that reason or if I just got lucky, but I think it is a very interesting observation that the career path you take also really matters.
Oh, for sure. And you have to have a passion for it. So you clearly have a passion for tech. And so then you can, because you have that meaning, that passion and purpose, you can kind of override some of these more uncomfortable things for you. For instance, the agoraphobia, you know, you have a command of the subject. So you feel safe and secure to talk about that in a crowd, even though just being in a crowd may not be your favorite thing. And just even, you know, your other things and the fact that you kind of shaped your career toward this more specific role that better suits you, whereas you started off again, in the tech, but not with really able to utilize your strengths. So how wonderful right. that you've been able to have that awareness. I mean, for me too, like I so badly wanted to progress in the physical therapy field that I wanted to be a manager. Well, guess what? I can't be a manager. I can barely manage myself. So let go of that, Christine, and understand what you are good at. I'm good at creating programs. I'm good at explaining high level information to people. I'm good at coordinating people. Go there. So, right.
Which actually is actually pretty similar in a way to what I do. I mean, I have no experience in healthcare, but I think what I think is interesting about dyslexia is people with dyslexia seem to be very good at exactly that, not being in the weeds, being more conceptual, mm-hmm. right? Understanding the relationship of many things in a more holistic way, yeah. which is super cool. I mean, that's like a superpower. It's awesome.
Yes. And then you can find support. You can find your copy editors to help have your back on those details. So that's another thing. If we look at entrepreneurs who are dyslexic, they talk about building a team around them of people to help support them where they don't have their strength. So, right. you know, I mean, just to circle back around, you know, we've got these children who are in school who are struggling to read. And if you're a parent of a child who is a dyslexic learner, you know, that feels very frustrating. Why can't they do this? Well, it is not because they are lazy or crazy or stupid. It is because they have a different way. Their brain is wired differently. But that doesn't mean that they can't learn. That doesn't mean that they won't learn. And especially if you have a passion, that's going to drive you to do things above and beyond. You were talking earlier about like people who kind of blame themselves or think that these traits are character flaws and like imploding on into themselves. The opposite would be to explode your anger and frustrations outward, which we see and probably those dyslexic learners who are in jail are the ones who have right. pushed that frustration outward. Or we could do something like you've learned to do, be aware of your challenges, be aware of your strengths, and go for those, and accept who you are and understand, like you said, everybody is different. Normal sucks. Why would you want to be average?
Right. Which, I mean, it's, yeah. And so honestly, in my life right now, where dyslexia is causing me the most issue is in my family life. Mm-hmm. My oldest is starting to read, and it's clear that she does not have dyslexia, or, you know, it's not obvious right now. She's already almost a better reader than me. I struggle reading kids' books to them. And I know I need to do it, and I feel guilty. I have a lot of guilt when I kind of push it off, because hearing myself read out loud just sounds funny. And like the way when I try to pronounce certain words in some of these kid books, like they use big words in a lot of these kid books. I don't like it. But the other thing is that my wife and I, me for a different reason, but I'm overcorrecting as it comes to education. I know that. Like, I know that I am kind of very anti public education in a big way. And I'm overcorrecting for what happened to me. But the other challenge I'm facing is a lot of anger related to the education system forcing the normal. That's its goal. Its goal is to force the normal. And we put our girls in a Montessori school to try to, you know, soften that a little bit. But even the public Montessori school in Boulder School District, which is supposed to be a fantastic school district, and I'll go on the record saying that I completely disagree, is forcing, you know, even my 5-year-old to kind of take these tests that are literally a test of your normality. That is all it is. And she has no clue why she's taking them. But it's just so that they can measure their kids and show that everybody's being cranked through the system
right.
in a very like systematic way. And they're all coming out the same. And yeah. That's actually where like I'm getting very angry, and I'm worried about how that's going to progress as they go through their school career.
Right. That, I mean, looking at it that way, it frustrated with tests, absolutely, but that's what we want to measure, right? We want to measure that we're all producing these achievers, but achieving in what? Achieving right. In answering the question. I agree with you that there's...
But written by somebody who has no acknowledgement or understanding of anything outside of like, great, your book smarts is great. But in many places, your book smarts are very limited. So,
right. And I think at a higher level, like in college and maybe even some high schools, that is changing. You know, definitely when you're in college, you have a lot more rein to decide what you're going to be studying. But definitely in the earlier grades, it is very frustrating. And just even looking at how much... You know, I was observing yesterday in my daughter's kindergarten class, and the teacher was phenomenal incorporating as much as she could in the time that she had with those kids. I mean, thinking all the things that she has to teach them, and test them too. And she really used every single second to, you know, even if they were doing a dance, like a brain break, and she said some sort of sentence, she asked them about the structure of the sentence that she just said. So, I was really impressed with that as a teacher, taking advantage of every single moment she had with those kids in a really active, real way. But I don't know that every teacher does that.
Yeah, and we haven't found it from the teachers at all. I know the teachers have to follow the system as much as anybody else follows the system. It's more my beef was in particular what happened when they said, oh, you know, Ava needs to go and do this thing. They didn't even really explain what it was. And they put her in a room, put her in front of a computer, which we have, even though I'm in tech, we have very strict no screen rules in our house. And so she's never been in front of a computer. She's been in front of an iPad a few times, but never in front of a computer. Put her in front of a computer, expect her to follow instructions on a screen to measure, you know, whatever system that they came out with. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, how did this benefit her? It just right. made her feel very uncomfortable.
Yep.
She in particular has demonstrated, even at this age, some anxiety issues. So that's my anxiety stuff. That's could be manifesting there. But and then they do that to her, and I was just furious. So it's more about how they choose to measure.
Yeah.
But not at the Montessori school. The teachers are fantastic.
That's good to hear. That's wonderful. And I think we can use that question. How does this benefit the child? How does this benefit me as a learner? And what do we have? What can we change? I mean, we can't change everything, but what do we right. have control over? How can we, you know, bring our viewpoints to the school district? And many educators are typical learners. Most yep. educators yep. learn.
It is that kind of job.
Yeah. So, but the information is getting out there. There is more science. The science for reading has always been there, but have the educators and the powers that be been acknowledging that. And so, you know, different organizations, all the Jeffco Kids, BB Kid, there's lots of kids identified with dyslexia organizations across Colorado that is really standing up for and improving access for testing, accommodations in class, across the board. But it needs to be more than just for children with dyslexia. Like you said, ADD,
right. ADHD. And I think, yeah, and I don't want to imply that everything's solved with programs. I think you've gotten this point from me when we've done the panels where some of the challenges of trying to make the world fit the disorder is that you're eventually going to go into a situation where those adaptations don't exist. Mm-hmm. I don't expect my employer to change how the company operates because of my anxiety disorders or dyslexia. I also know that if I was overly coddled as a kid and I didn't go through that whole process, that journey, then I wouldn't be as good at my skill set of synthesizing information as I am. But I think that just like if a large public company can come up with this idea that you can come to work and be a human, and understanding that today you can learn anything you want to learn on it whenever. Now, some of it is not great. Like, you could learn to be a flat earther tomorrow too, or you can learn to understand gravity, but you can learn it tomorrow if you want to. So what we're teaching should be how to learn, and more of like kind of the conceptual stuff.
Yeah.
And organizations just need to allow you to be a human. That's it. Let's just don't make it so I feel like I have to hide, you know, challenges that I go through. Just let me be open about it. Let's not dwell on it, but let's just understand. I'm going to be aware, you're going to be aware. And then I think the other key element is finding a mentor if you can. And a mentor doesn't have to be somebody who gives you answers. A mentor could just be a peer. Like, you're a peer to me in dyslexia. Like, just finding somebody else that you can riff off with the same challenges. Mm-hmm. And both understand, be on the same page. We're like, yep, I get it.
Right.
Helps a lot.
No, absolutely. I agree with that wholeheartedly, because otherwise you do feel like you're on an island. You do feel isolated in the sense of, I'm the only one at my job or in my situation, that why can't I do what everybody else can do? And other people, neurotypical or other individuals who don't struggle with this at work, don't have the answer for you, because it's not a problem for them.
Right.
Things are easy for them in this realm, and they don't quite understand why you struggle. And so their solutions to your problem aren't benefiting you, and to have a peer support to kind of, talk about that is wonderful. So, thank you so much, Chris, for talking with me today. You've touched on some really important, I'm going to pull out some quotes here, because, you know, allowing people just to be human, that's so, I mean,
hadn't fully kicked in when we first started, so some of my rambling stuff. But well, now I'm fully caffeinated and I'm good to go.
Fantastic. Well, we'll have you on again. I really would like to hear more about the projects that your committee or your group at work is doing. And one of the side projects that I'm doing is trying to get a database of really dyslexic learners across the country. And just for kids, students, like, I know when I was growing up, I want to be a physical therapist. Like, it'd be great to reach out and find another dyslexic learner who was a physical therapist, or my son really wants to be an architect. Call out there for anyone who is a dyslexic, dyslexic architect. I need to talk to you. So,
well, if we need to build an app around that, I'd be happy to help.
Ooh, yay!
that would be a great project.
Fun! I'm glad to have friends. Well, we will touch base about building that. I'm so excited to even hear you say that. And again, thank you so much for your insights, and look forward to talking with you again.
All right. Well, thank you for inviting me.
Bye.
Have a good day.
Today's quick tip. Okay, so today's tips for teaching a student who has dyslexia is to think about like the irregular words or those tricky words. And there are a lot of tricky words. I learned this information by watching a talk on YouTube under the Reading League. And the Reading League has so many great videos to watch from educators. And so I'm just going to kind of summarize what the irregular word or tricky word video said. And I'll go ahead and I'll put the link in the show notes to that particular video because I thought it was really informative. Every single thing I watch from the Reading League has a lot of great information. So the first thing she wanted to point out is that irregular words are not sight words. So basically, a sight word is a word that your child knows just by sight. So inherently, there is no word that is a sight word until your child knows it by sight. So the way that they kind of teach them in schools, like, here's a list of sight words, but your child does not yet have that word into their brain yet orthographically. They don't know what that word looks like. That word is going to look very similar to a lot of other words. And because it can't be sounded out, sometimes it can, or that when you do sound it out, it doesn't always follow the rules. From the get-go, it's not a sight word. It would be a tricky word or an irregular word. And so the way that we typically are being taught this in school is just straight out memorization of these high frequency words. And that's what they focus on, just memorizing the word. Well, that's really going to be limiting for our children if we have to rely on their memory of and differentiating between all of these words that seemingly don't follow any rule. So she was saying that it's actually better if we point out the irregular sound. She used examples like they from word what, where the unit of sounds in the word don't necessarily follow the general rule. And if you highlight them, then your child can start keying in on, what, you know, why doesn't that sound make the same sound that I'm expecting it to make? And just kind of keying on in on what's different. And then also, are there other words that are similarly irregular? So she also is just talking about a word wall versus a sound wall. And you know, in school, a lot of times you'll see word walls with, maybe they start with the same letter and all of the words that start with the same letter, as opposed to a sound wall. My son is practicing his drums downstairs, so hopefully we can't hear that too much. But, you know, side note about dyslexics learning how to play an instrument. I am a dyslexic learner, and I learned how to play an instrument, and my son is doing quite well on the drums. So if your child has a desire to learn, they absolutely can. We'll stop there with our tip for the day, but check out that Reading League video for great information on learning tricky words.